The spirit of performance defines Acura. And now, it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura has been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
Live from the NASDAQ market site overlooking New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. I'm Melissa Lee. Your traders on the desk are Tim Seymour, Carter Worth, Karen Feinerman, and Steve Grasso. Tonight on Fast, is it time to rethink your safety strategy? The one chart that has the chart master pumping the brakes, plus investors putting the pedal to the metal on Uber today. We'll tell you what is driving the action. And later, skipping breakfast, why the most important meal of the day could leave Wendy's investors with a serious case of indigestion. But we begin with late-breaking news out of Washington. The president talking about a China trade deal a moment ago. Let's get to Eamon Javers live at the White House with the very latest. Eamon.
Yeah, Melissa, that's right. The president was in the Roosevelt Room signing as part of a signing ceremony for a smaller trade deal with the Japanese. But he also talked extensively about the prospects for a trade deal between the United States and China, given that negotiations are kicking back up. This week, the president was asked if he would accept a smaller deal rather than waiting for that grand big deal that he's been pushing for. Here's what he said.
I think that we just have to see what happens. I would much prefer a big deal, and I think that's what we're shooting for. Can something happen? I guess maybe. Who knows? But I think it's probably unlikely.
And I also asked Melissa, the president, whether or not he told Xi Jinping, as has been reported, that he would remain quiet about the Hong Kong protests during the course of these China trade negotiations. The president said, no, I didn't. He said, but we're negotiating. If anything happened bad, that would be bad for the negotiation. Politically, it would be very tough. The president sort of going on at some length here about the protests in Hong Kong and admiring the American flags, the Trump signs that he's seen in the crowd there, and admiring the pro-democracy protesters, but ultimately saying that the protests in Hong Kong and the trade negotiations with the Chinese are not linked, Melissa.
It's interesting, Eamon, because just, I want to say, a month and a half ago or so, the president, I believe, had made some comment to the effect of, we want to see that resolve first and then we can talk, right, as if the trade talks would be contingent on the protests in Hong Kong dying down. And yet here right. We are today, and it's a much different story.
Yeah, the president simply saying today that he hopes it's resolved in a humane way.
Yep. Eamon, thank you. Eamon Javers joining us from the White House. This could be the biggest market-moving event this week, and we have President Trump making some comments today. How do you feel about this as a catalyst?
Well, we had some weekend press that had right. people a little concerned, right? So what are the core issues? Obviously, if you ask most people, I think this is certainly bipartisan. We want protection of American intellectual property. I think we, on some level, care about subsidies, although, you know, the industrial subsidies that China embarks upon domestically should not really be our issue, if you ask me. So maybe no one asked for my opinion. But as we get into the most thorny trade issues as to getting a deal, USIP is the most important. The problem here is they're not going to put into any legislative, or it's not going into law in China, and that's going to be a big deal. So can we get there? You know, it becomes very difficult. And when you add in the subsidies part of it, where I don't think China's going to play ball, I don't see a lot that they're really agreeing on right
now. So everyone had thought we were going to get little deals going up to it. I think that's what the market was looking for. Maybe a little deal and then maybe something bigger. Something bigger is not coming anymore. They're not dealing with IP. It's not going to happen. It's a true negative for the market.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm afraid of, you know, any progress on the China trade deal, I think, is really a head fake. And I think we keep seeing it, you know, when the market gets, you know, rough and down, then Trump tweets something positive about how progress is being made, mm-hmm. or constructive talks or whatever it is. And I think it wouldn't shock me to see the administration sort of have a new perspective on what a trade deal should look like, how vast it should be, sure, what it should cover, and to have that be a much narrower focus and then declare some kind of victory. That could happen. But I don't think that's the kind of real trade deal that we need to really support the economy, to really get executives, mostly CEOs, who are thinking about what do they do for expenditures, how do they think about their business going forward, to have confidence that we're not going to see tariffs up and down. That's the real problem.
I think that's one of the thorniest issues. And if we don't think that China is going to comply, let's say, with any agreement on intellectual property, right, and tariffs remain in place, that's going to be used as leverage against the Chinese to get them to comply. And that has been the very thing that has caused all this uncertainty in the markets.
Right. And hence the volatility, and hence the hope for a resolution, but it's just not coming. And I think the real trap is that we know that this is the single area of the market, industrials, where after the election, it was the most bid up. And actually, on a relative basis, industrials as a sector peaked on the 1st of December, just after the election in 2018, and they've been going straight down ever since, making new nine-year lows just this week.
Well, you're right.
So at some point, are they cheap, or is it just more of a trap?
Well, if you think about, let's take FedEx, for example, a stock that I think at these levels, trading at, you know, at $14 a share, it's 10 times next year. We know FedEx can get cheaper because I bet I said that at 180. But that was a $280 stock. Stock's down 50% from the blow off top, which is in Jan of 2018, which is essentially a month before we got trade talk. So if you look at a FedEx and you look at the steel stocks, they are all telling you how important the industrial side that Carter's talking about is to this. And there's no relief, I think, until you get some certainty. Again, we don't expect that the global economy turns on a dime. You need CEOs to understand how their business changes.
At the same time, when I read that Bloomberg article, as we all read early this morning, and I thought, I wonder what the markets are going to do today. I thought they'd be lower on because there's basically no other news in the market. There are no earnings, no economic data. We had that article saying that it's going to be a slimmed down trade deal, and yet we finished fractionally off.
I think you had Larry Kudlow also talking about that they're not going to bar companies, Chinese companies, from listing here or delist companies listing here. So I think that was a tailwind.
Of an affirmation.
That was a tailwind. But I think this is definitely a negative for the overall markets if a bigger deal can't get done.
And the trajectory of the day was negative, right? To think about it, the futures were down all night. Right. And you're worried and have the headline, and we're thinking, and then it starts coming back, which draws money in, only then to reverse and close out near the lows. That's very bad action, or they said a bad tape, right?
So then what does the action of a stock like an Apple tell us, or some of these semiconductor names, which did well in today's session, and arguably are the poster children of the trade war?
Well, Apple's, to me, relatively easy to understand. I'm long Apple. I feel like we talk at length on this show about some drivers for Apple, which include a better revenue mix, more geared toward services, higher multiple capital markets, maybe now at 5G. Semis are harder to explain. I mean, think about semis, which are basically a couple points from all-time highs in the face of really not only the cyclicality of a trade war, but some of the bellwethers in that sector, including Texas Instruments and even Intel, throwing a lot of cold water on their guidance for where we even see restocking, let alone actual real end demand. So it's concerning, and I don't think you chase semis here, that's for sure.
Apple changed, the dialogue changed from an actual China trade stock to a stock based on fundamentals. And everyone was looking for the services to outweigh whatever the hardware was lacking or the slowing growth. Now, if you have hardware kicking in along with services, that to me is how the story changed. I don't think it has anything to do with China at all anymore. I think
just because they're going to sell more iPhone 11s, all of a sudden the China threat is no longer?
Well, I think that the China threat had dissipated to a larger extent in the last couple of weeks. And then when the notes started coming out that the iPhone is actually selling better, and now all of a sudden everyone said we discounted that to a secular decline, I think the story does change for the better.
I think that they kind of get a pass on this quarter, right? So this isn't the revolutionary phone, I guess, that, you know, that we're going to see for 5G. So I think they
on the calendar third quarter, right?
Right.
Yes.
That they announced October 30. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
the 11th.
What?
The 11th, right? Is that where we at? The iPhone.
Oh, the iPhone 11.
Yeah.
Oh, we're talking about the quarter, the pass on the quarter.
The quarter.
So I think that, you know, if we see services, that part of the story needs to stay intact. Right. We need that. We want to see, you know, how the evolution of Apple streaming does. But I think that they kind of have a pass on the hardware for a little while. I do think the China threat still exists. There was an article over the weekend about Tim Cook's relationship with Trump.
President Trump. How he's been able
to- Isn't this your point? I think this is your point. You're not even trying to make a point, Mel. But I mean,
well
Apple,
done. Well done
Apple
for that
absolutely
point.
Is a trade war stock,
it
even though I know
it's still
Steve's
going
saying.
To be subject to tariffs.
And so Apple is kind of levitating, despite the fact that we know that there's bottom-up drivers for Apple. It's the same thing with semis, and it's basically a market that seems somewhat blasé about a lot of bad news and should have done more today. And what does that tell you about where markets are? I think it does tell you, we talk also a lot about positioning. There's a lot of hedge fund managers that have missed their bogey, and it's time to drive it into year end. And I do think when you look at where net longs are in the hedge fund world, even though gross longs are very big, people are not positioned long and need to find stocks like Apple that are not terribly controversial to get long.
Apple is as poised as any stock in the market to break out, and not many stocks are, right? So what do we know? It's day-to-day action. Of all the things that have ever been tested, the biggest quench ups in the world, relative strength consistently in the ranks is a factor that one wants to embrace. The day-to-day relative strength, the week-over-week relative strength is very impressive. On a classic charting level, it's a breakout candidate. And I think it's going to break out.
And what do semis look like?
Semis are a little, well, they're to be marveled at how well they hold in there, but they're not poised to break out.
So perhaps they are trade war stocks at this
but
point.
But the semis actually felt to me that they bounced on a smaller deal getting done, and that anticipation, the positive anticipation of a smaller deal getting done without any IP involved. I'm surprised that President Trump hasn't walked that back a little bit and said, we're going to get that done in stages. We're going to get it either in stages or a big deal, but we're going to get something done. He should be walking it back right now.
So you have been relatively bullish on right. the market. So now that you think that a big deal is off the table, do you pare back your expectations?
Yeah, I do pare them back a bit. And I also think that once the deal gets done, it is a very large shortable event for the overall market.
Because you mean the small deal that you're expecting?
The small deal, but I think that whenever a deal gets done, that's your time to ring the bell and probably start exiting some longs. Because China is the growth engine of the world, or at least we've been told that for years, and it has been the case. So if they give up something, by its nature, their growth slows even more. If that slows even more, we slow.
Not necessarily.
What's the risk reward, though, for staying long at this point, just a couple percentage from all-time highs, versus the downside, the sell-off that we'll see after that deal is announced?
Yeah,
Does that work out?
Yeah, it's diminishing to me, where at this point you had to stay long because you have Powell easing, where last year we had the rest of the world was tightening. Powell was tightening. Now he's changed. He's softer. He's more dovish. You have that caveat of a trade deal getting done. There's not, you do have earnings, so there's a fundamental case that I think that earning estimates came in too hard. So you have that. But other than that, you should probably
But again,
be
the notion of
sales.
Staying long, that's just 10 stocks, right? I mean, 10 stocks are more than the bottom 350. You've got, think about the preeminent brokerage firm in the world, Goldman Sachs, is down at 2- and 3- and 4-year lows, Morgan Stanley. It's never been that good. The S&P has been good, but the internals have been struggling for a long time.
What's the normal? You have some number of leaders, obviously,
yeah,
and
always,
then a number
always,
of laggards, right?
It,
so
what
how
happens
is this compared
about,
to the
it,
average?
It's no different than when good technique argues for clustering into fewer and fewer names. Children know this when they play musical chairs, right? They're casual and they start to go around, but then they get tighter and tighter, and they jump from chair to chair. People hide in names. It's good technique until the end. They say, well, I'll stay in Visa, I'll stay in Microsoft. As more and more stocks, from Caterpillar to FedEx to brokers to banks to industrials, roll over. Guess what's happening now? The big rails are all rolling over.
By the way, we have never played musical chairs on. We love games on Fast Money.
We play it all the time.
Money.
I sit there sometimes.
That's true.
Chairs are brought
excellent
in. Sometimes
point.
There's no chair there.
Musical chairs all the time.
Okay, so in terms of musical Fed chairs, Powell is going to speak tomorrow. And if we don't have a trade deal, there's no question that the Fed, to me, is going to go. And I mean more than once. And to me right now, I think the Fed only goes once. I mean, if you listen to Rosengren, if you listen to some of the other folks, they're not ready to do much at all. So I'm not saying that bad news is good news, which is what this kind of implies. In fact, I'm just telling you that in terms of look at the bond market, which also the 10-year actually sold off half a point today. Should that have been happening on a day when people thought that maybe the economic news got much worse when the trade?
But bad news was good news last week. So when we got that bad number last week, you saw December. That's what you're talking about. They're going in October. You saw December. The odds of them going doubled. So bad news for the market has become good news, at least on the rates front, for a more conducive bullish Fed or pro-growth Fed.
I think it doesn't make sense. I understand that's happening. It doesn't make sense to me that a weaker economy would bring the Fed back in to try to strengthen the economy. I'd much rather see better economic numbers.
Right.
And cut to the chase.
Balance.
We do have some data. I agree the Fed, doesn't. There's mixed voices there. But.
Right.
Let's see. We have some PPI data tomorrow. If any of that comes in hot, we have the unemployment at a 50-year low. That's some cover for a Fed that doesn't want to keep cutting.
Right. Coming up, Uber catching a lift as one Wall Street analyst gets bullish on the stock. We'll tell you if the ride-sharing company's stellar rating can last. Plus, the Chartmaster says one of the year's best-performing sectors is about to break down. He'll tell us what it is. We're live from Times Square in New York City. Much more Fast Money right after this.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. Saving, researching, investing. Now you can take those investments to the next level with Yahoo Finance, our sponsor today. I have an investment account with Schwab and a 401k with Fidelity, and I use Yahoo Finance to consolidate them so it's incredibly easy to manage. They've been helping great investors like you for over 25 years. So whether you're a seasoned investor or just looking to level up, Yahoo Finance can simplify things, putting all your tools and data in one spot. Yahoo Finance takes a 360-degree look at the financial news cycle, from breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, and customizable charts. They've got you covered. You can see all of your 401k and other investments by securely linking your brokerage accounts. Yahoo Finance gives you insights and helps you see your wealth in its entirety. That big picture perspective helps smart investors become even better. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor. YahooFinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com. That's YahooFinance.com.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Uber speeding ahead today after Citi upgraded the ride-sharing company to a buy rating. The bank saying it is optimistic about a positive shift in sentiment towards Uber's core business. So are you pooling with Citi? Getting in on the action here.
Wow.
Some of the parts.
We love puns. We love entendre. And
it's a lot there. Throughout the show, it's strong.
There.
It's really strong. The sum of the parts I thought was interesting because it was zero for the other
zero
bets.
For everything else. Yeah. So, but you have to take a big leap on what the ride business is worth, which they have 31, I think, right where right here. So, I don't know what to make of that. If I don't love that the theory is a shift in sentiment, right? I don't want sentiment to be what will drive Uber. I think they need, a shift to profitability, say. That would be something that would interest me maybe more. But I understand what they're saying. They're talking about the next evolution, which is autonomous vehicles, electric vehicles, and that's 2.0 for Uber. And that's, they even have in their, wildest dreams an upside of 102, I believe, and a downside of, maybe 18, 19. So it still doesn't make me want to buy here. But I understand how some people think maybe it's bottomed out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think sentiment has changed. I'm with Karen on this. Obviously, you look at the recent low, the 28.31, I believe, or thereabouts, down to it's 28.31. That has to hold, and it has to hold for some days for me to start to feel more confident in buying this thing going forward. I need more of a base before I start to get involved.
Right. I mean, again, if your first day in life is your best day, this is not a good thing, right? I mean, this thing comes out of the gate and falls dead on the floor.
Yeah.
So what is there to, you can pick around and one day call a bottom. I think you're making that point. Why do it?
Right.
And then when you start hearing some of the parts, that's so down there in the future, right? Right now, sentiment is bad and the stock is bad.
Right.
But philosopher Braxton Worth never ceases to amaze with all the right terms. And I actually was going to point out some of the parts as well, because some of the parts usually also is a discounted cash flow model. that's coming up with this number, which to me, does anyone have a dartboard around here? Because look, ultimately, that's what this becomes, especially when the discount rate of the company and the terminal value of this rideshare business, which we say we're marketing almost nothing, but also the discount rate of a company really determines the sum of the parts. So while I use DCF and I don't want to poo-poo the whole function, I think you can kind of play around with valuations for a company like this right now. So to suddenly say it's gotten too cheap, I'm not sure we know what the rideshare business is worth.
All right. Despite today's boost, it's been a rocky road for shares of Uber. The ride-hailing giant is still down more than 4% in the past month, while rival Lyft is down a whopping 12%. Other hot IPOs like Zoom, Video, Beyond Meat, Pinterest also struggled over the past month. But despite the recent IPO pain, Wall Street is still placing bets on Airbnb as it prepares to go public. Let's get to Deirdre Bosa with more on this. Hey, Deirdre.
Hey, Melissa. Well, there's lots to like about Airbnb, but there's also some big question marks, which I'll get to in a minute. First, though, here's how the company makes money. It takes about 15% commission on each booking for hotels. This is a space which Airbnb is making major moves into. That fee can be higher. In terms of executive team and board, its founders, Brian Chesky, Nathan Balazsczyk, and Joe Gebbia are still at the company. Chesky, as CEO, of course. Last year, they poached Dave Stevenson from Amazon to be its CFO, and Belinda Johnson, the COO, has been there since 2011, and she's been called the Sheryl Sandberg of Airbnb. Now, its board includes some key veterans with Wall Street experience. In May, it added former Apple exec Angela Ahrendts to a roster that includes former American Express CEO Ken Chenault and Ann Mather, former Pixar CFO, who also serves on the Netflix and Alphabet boards. There is, however, guys, a lot that we still don't know about the company that may or may not be as appealing, like its costs for things such as insurance and its host guarantee. Competition is also heating up while Airbnb is moving into the traditional hotel space with its acquisition of Hotel Tonight and its New York hotel-like project. Big hotel chains like Marriott and IHG are encroaching on home sharing. Now, investors will also be keen to learn about its corporate governance, which is top of mind for many after the WeWork debacle. And perhaps the biggest risk to Airbnb's business, like Uber, like Lyft, which you guys were just talking about, is regulation. Like ride sharing, home sharing is facing increased scrutiny from lawmakers in different cities. In New York, regulators are cracking down on home sharing, and the company is being blamed in part for the city's housing shortage. Melissa, back to you.
Deirdre, but a key point here is that it's eyeing a direct listing and not an IPO, correct? I mean, it doesn't need the money.
Right.
Theoretically, the pricing could be a lot different than what would happen if it went public.
That's right. As of the first quarter of this year, it had $3.5 billion on its balance sheet. As far as we know, it's not bleeding money like the ride-sharing companies, and that's why it is talked about as, you know, a major candidate for direct listings. And VCs say that if it goes that route, that could encourage a lot of other startups here in the Valley to do
all
so.
Right. Deirdre, thank you. Deirdre Bosa in San Francisco. Do we feel better about Airbnb than some of the others?
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, there seems to be less of a smoke around the corporate governance. But it's also, here's the point, the structure and the difference between an IPO and a direct listing is one where you don't have to show as much disclosure. So opening the books, one of the issues with WeWork is that they were going for an IPO, and those that have watched this and said, hey, there's some stuff that maybe we're not ready to show, sometimes it's not necessarily even, you know, really deep, dark secrets, but it's actually a company that has a certain part of the business that it's waiting to mature, and they recognize the market will discount that. But a direct listing allows a big company that doesn't necessarily need new funds to get liquidity for insiders on the way out without having to raise new money and open themselves up to all kinds of scrutiny.
Is the regulatory issue a big one for you?
For the housing issues?
Mm-hmm.
Not really. I mean, obviously Uber and Lyft facing headwinds with the AB5 in California. But no, not really. I mean, to me, WeWork, though, was an absolute watershed event for sure.
Right.
And that, I mean, I could see why they'd want to do a direct listing, but it's also a segue to getting public. If they sell a very small amount, maybe it doesn't matter so much exactly where it comes, but it's a good segue to getting public. I think the days of just, you know, endless growth at any price, profitability somewhere way down the line in some vague way, those are gone for a while. The pendulum swung way too far. Mm-hmm. It's going to take a while for it to swing back.
You can read more about Airbnb's plans to go public on our website, CNBC.com. We are live from the Nasdaq Market Site in Times Square. Here's what else is coming up on the show.
Time to rethink the safety trade? The one sector the Chartmaster says is shooting off massive warning flares. And later, a frosty call on Wendy's, why the company's big breakfast bet could leave investors with some serious hunger pains. We'll explain when Fast Money returns.
This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Stocks finishing the day in the red, but despite the recent turmoil, all but one sector is still sitting in the green for the year. Our Chartmaster, though, says one of the best performing groups in the market is shooting some warning flares. Carter's over at the Plaza to break it down. Carter, take it away.
So this is just a very simple look at utilities. It's the most crowded in a way, or most popular, most loved, and maybe belongs here because of DCF and low interest rates. But what we do know is two things have happened that are fairly extraordinary. On Friday last week, the utility sector clocked its 10th consecutive advance on a week-over-week basis. That has happened two other times in the history of the data, and thereafter it wasn't particularly good. Now, while two other instances is hardly statistically significant, still it's worth noting. So in the late spring of 2003, we completed a 10-week run, and what happened 1 week later, 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, 4 weeks later is right there on the screen for you to see. The same thing happened, a 10-week consecutive run in the early spring of 2013, and the utility sector did this. So we, on Friday, just completed 10 runs. Utility is one of the worst performing areas of the market today, and adjusted for beta, particularly poor. I think it's the beginning of what would be an unwind. Let's look at a few other things. Just the chart itself. This is the entire decade, 2009 to where we are. One thing we know is you can get too far above trend. And if you were just to measure how far above the 150-day moving average the utility sector is, more often than not, you start to get some counter-trend move. And that's what I think we're set up for here. Another way to do it, same chart, remove the moving average, and just put a channel on it. I mean, it has literally lived in this channel like some sort of pinball machine, perfectly, over and over and over and over and over and over. And then what has it done? It is blown out through the top. That's what a blow-off top starts to look at. So again, the thinking is, a little too good, fade this very crowded area of the market. And then, just for what it's worth, what kind of sell-off could you get? Exact same chart again. You can see these drawdowns here. Here's a 14, here's a 14, here's a 13, a 13, a 19, a 15, a 17, and a 10. You know, do you get this kind of thing coming in here? I think you do. Let's say it's even 3 or 4, or it's 6. But either way, does it just keep advancing from here? I think the odds are low, and therefore take action.
Carter, can I ask a potentially stupid question?
Oh, come on. No such thing, Mel.
You know, one could look at the chart and say higher lows and higher highs, so why wouldn't it break out?
Right, but I mean that's the sequence. But if you were to look at just that sequence, higher highs and higher lows, the sequence calls for the next higher low, meaning for some form of dip. Even if one believes it's this, and that interest rates are going much, much lower and utilities outperform, the sequence, if in fact that's what we're talking about, right? It's just maybe what you said, a slight dip and then more. But I think it's more than a slight dip.
All right.
That wasn't a dumb question. Every girl, that was a smart
Well, you know, inquiring minds. Steve, do you like utilities?
I do like utilities, up 25% year to date. And I don't disregard what Carter's saying to me. It's a staircase. So you're going to get that pullback. You have to look at relative strength index, the RSI, see when the XLUs get overbought, and then you want to bleed out of them a little bit. But the people who own these own them for long term. So they're not going to buy and sell them. They're going to stay the path. Traders will.
Well, I think to some extent that's right, because this is a very sort of buy and hold area of the market.
Right.
But we're getting record inflows into ETFs that track utilities like the XLU.
It's a different kind of money coming in.
That's not a buy and hold crowd, right?
And if you're grabbing it at these kinds of highs, if we go through, just remember, utilities, as Carter pointed out, they have these enormous drawdowns as well. I mean, in December, basically, when everything was pulling back, you lost 10% like that in the XLU, which tells you you're not immune. And when actually there's more momentum in these things at those peaks, when the market is most vulnerable, that is something to watch out for.
All right. Coming up, one fast food stock set to report this week, and options traders are betting it is about to serve up stellar earnings. Plus, Tesla revving higher as its electric truck bet gains some steam. So is it really all about the Model 3? Much more Fast Money coming up next. Stay with us. Welcome back to Fast Money. Hope you're hungry because we're about to get a full smorgasbord of restaurant results. Let's get to Kate Rogers back at headquarters with the setup. Hey, Kate.
Hey, Melissa. That's right. Well, it all kicks off tomorrow morning before the bell with earnings from Domino's, where delivery has been the key storyline. The company's been admittedly facing some headwinds from the growth of third-party delivery aggregators as Domino's continues to conquer that all in-house. Now, Americans spent some $10 billion on third-party delivery last year alone, so CNBC took a look at recent earnings transcripts and events to look at the key themes at major restaurant players. And we found that while mentions of delivery have stayed somewhat steady, names of specific companies from Postmates to DoorDash have actually increased. We can expect that trend to continue. It's been a big boost to business for brands like Chipotle and McDonald's as they expand their reach. Restaurant upgrades and tech enhancements will also be in focus as companies are continuing to introduce kiosks, mentions of which have also increased. Companies are also expanding offerings like mobile order and pay around the globe. Both Starbucks and Chipotle in particular have continued to emphasize the offering and have seen loyalty program enrollments increase as a result. And one more thing we notice, while value and menu items are key, mentions of breakfast actually peaked a few years ago. This as Wendy's makes a full push into the offering. Wendy's actually got a downgrade on that from Cowen today to Market Perform, saying that breakfast is not a long-term competitive advantage. So very interesting. We'll have to see how it all plays out, Melissa. Back over to you.
All right, Kate, thank you. So as these food names gear up to report, should investors put their money where their mouth is, Tim?
Well, they certainly have. We hate puns and we hate. Yeah. So look, in the case of Domino's, I think some of these concerns in terms of some structural issues in their business, which they're choosing to do in-house versus outsourcing, are very real. This is a company, if you look at the explosive growth of Domino's, it was a 5-year run that through essentially August of 2018 was one of the best performing stocks in the world, let alone the restaurant space. I think at 26 times, it's growing into the valuation. In terms of valuation relative to its peer group at this point, this is not an expensive company. The question is, truly, is it becoming a value trap? I know at 26 times, that sounds a little pricey to be calling it value. But relative to some of the restaurant peers, which have been very defensive places to hide out, and companies that have become growth stocks because of their loyalty programs, because of their essentially the delivery and the larger ticket items and what it means for analysts, Domino's hasn't had that.
You rode the Domino's train for a long time.
I did. I'm not in it for a while now. Growth is actually slowing. International growth is slowing. Mm-hmm. U.S. growth is slowing. I'm looking at a chart for Jack in the Box, a name that I don't talk about a lot. It's digesting that blowout in earnings.
Well done.
Ah, nice.
Nice job.
That blowout in earnings that they had back in August. And it's absorbed it, digested it, and moving higher from there. I still like that name.
Which name looks good in this space?
My favorite here is Starbucks. It was the single strongest, and it's had one of the more important givebacks, and the sell-off leaves it at a level of support. But what we do know is there's sort of the greats, Yum, Chipotle, not really, but let's say Starbucks, McDonald's, Yum, and then there's all the other sort of trying to be important players. And Starbucks, I think, is best in class here.
Is this a good gauge for the consumer? When it comes to retail?
It is, I think, a good gauge for the consumer because they're employed, right? And they have money to spend. Wages are going up. That's sort of the flip side. Wages for the consumer in the lower end are going up. Mm-hmm. But also, this is a real headwind for restaurants.
Right.
It is a real headwind that some of them, you know, are actually going to have to decrease the amount of hours or staff that they have. So McDonald's has just done such an extraordinary job. I know it's pulled back a little, maybe not a lot, but
I mean, they have the last same-store sales numbers I thought were so impressive that I wouldn't be surprised to see that momentum continue.
Right. You got the push-pull. I mean, wages are increasing for some of these fast food chains, but they're also increasing in technology, like the kiosks, for instance, which may even eliminate the need for people at some point.
They do. And at the kiosk, as you add and you specialize and you change this and you do that, you double up here and you get all natural.
Extra cheese.
You're spending more money. And the ticket sizes are truly what's most impressive, especially at McDonald's. That's how they're growing same-store sales in the U.S., you know, close to 5%, which is unheard of.
Do you feel like people aren't making judgments on you if you get, like, a double or if you, like, supersize?
It's why I go kiosk when I ask for three pieces of cheese. 80%
of the profits come to the drive-thru.
It's a very personal decision, Mel. I don't know why you pointed to me. Like, I'm doing weird stuff in kiosk.
You spoke about it as if you have personal experience. You would add more things. Your ticket size gets bigger.
You know what? I'm weird at the kiosk.
Made a great point at McDonald's. Their digital investments that they've made. If WeWork can be called a technology company, then McDonald's should be called a technology company as well. They've rejiggered that menu so many times. They've gotten rid of so many different SKUs. They put it where they get you through that drive-through. Family of six. Go ahead, Tim.
McCafe, too.
You know,
I mean, they've turned into a coffee shop. They've done everything. So. Yeah.
All right.
I love Mickey D's.
Well, options traders are betting on big moves when Domino's reports tomorrow. Let's get to Mike Coe in San Francisco. Mike.
Yeah, we did see quite a lot of options activity in Domino's today. It traded 12 times its average daily call volume, 9 times its average daily put volume. And the options market is implying a move of over 7% by the end of the week after they report earnings tomorrow. And that is larger than the just over 5% that they typically average. One of the trades that I was looking at that I thought was kind of interesting was the weekly 217.5, 250 risk reversal. So in this trade, that option trader was buying the 250 calls, selling the 217 puts. They were spending $4.65 to put that trade on. So that's a little less than 2% of the current stock price. The idea here is that they will get long the stock if it rallies through that 250 strike on the upside. They also could get long the stock if it falls because they're short that downside put. But they won't be long the stock until it declines by at least 10% if it should disappoint on earnings. As for myself, I'm kind of with Carter here because I'm going to Starbucks myself. That's the place that doesn't really have those aggregator delivery challenges, I think. Still paying $3 for a cup of coffee, and I get it myself.
All right, Mike. Thanks for that. Mike Coe in San Francisco. For more options action, be sure to tune into the full show. That's Friday, 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Up next, Tesla shares getting a pop thanks to Pepsi. We'll break down what is driving today's gains. Don't go anywhere. Much more Fast Money right after this.
The Halftime Report is honoring America's veterans once again this year. If you're a veteran or part of a military family, we want you to come see us live at the Women's Memorial in Arlington, Virginia on November 8th. Tickets are free. Just email your name and phone number to veterantickets@cnbc.com. The deadline is Monday, October 14th. Again, come see the Halftime Team honor America's veterans at the Women's Memorial in Arlington, Virginia, November 8th. For free tickets, email us at veteranstickets@cnbc.com. See you there.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Tesla charging up today after analysts at Morgan Stanley said the electric car maker is getting, quote, real-world validation for semi-trucks. This as Pepsi announced plans to use 15 Tesla electric trucks at a California facility as part of a near-zero emissions project. Morgan Stanley says these large real-deal customers with sophisticated supply chains are a huge milestone for Tesla. So is the electric semi gaining speed, Karen?
It's endless. It's interesting, right? I think.
It's really particularly endless. Look, it's great for a Monday, though.
If this were a drinking game, our viewers would be drunk.
Yes.
Well, I mean, the Tesla, I don't know, was up about $800-900 million today on, I think, this story. So 15 trucks, I think I saw on their website, $200,000 about per truck. So that's $3 million. So that's a good bang for your buck for the stock to have sell $3 million, to have an order for $3 million worth of trucks. That's great, though. Obviously, I'd love to see the evolution of electric vehicles for trucks. That would be great. It's still, I mean, it's Tesla. They're talking about end of next year. Originally, it was going to be end of this year.
How many times are they
get hard? It's hard to get really excited that this is really going to happen. This is a great customer, obviously, but this is a tiny, tiny little.
Wasn't this news out a year and a half ago? They were putting in a big order. They were first in the line, securing. It was December of 2017. We were waiting. Pepsi was going to be first in line to get all these big semis. As Karen said, we're still waiting. And we're still waiting to. I mean, this is not a reason to go buy the stock. The reason to go buy the stock is when you start to see these guys are becoming less of a cash burn story. I'm not even going to say cash flow generative, but the story is the balance sheet right now. It's not even deliveries. The story is, can this company find a way to be profitable? Because I don't think capital markets are wide open to them.
It is the balance sheet. It's also the short interest is still hovering somewhere around 30%, just a shade underneath that. But when you look at it on a stock chart, it's trying to build a base. I would not own Tesla. I believe what Tim says and everyone else on this desk, it's a balance sheet question. It's not a technical or fundamental story. The fundamentals are not there yet. You have to look at the technicals.
I mean, it is trying to build the base, but it's the key word is trying, right?
Yeah.
It's very early in that process, and more often than not, unless you've really completed it, which is the time to go, it ends up being very disappointing.
Right.
Right. So,
in terms of this particular business segment, though, the semi-truck, I mean, it seems like corporations have mandates now to become more green, much more so than an individual consumer who might choose to buy a Model 3 or not choose to buy a Model 3. And this electrified semi-truck is the only one on the market so far.
Look, it's awesome. And being green also means being fuel efficient, which also means saving a lot of money. And Pepsi's already started to, I mean, they can budget this and very easily rationalize this purchase at a time when they already have semis already out there on the road. So this is good business because it's green, and I believe in green.
And that's,
but I also
that's
believe
a great
it needs
point,
to actually be profitable.
Because we could all go through this desk and see how many other competitors there are in the car business. But you can't do it in this business. So for them to start getting these orders with zero competition, if they could start building some sort of a tailwind in that segment of the economy, that starts to change the narrative.
But the competition
for
will
Tesla.
Come. It will come. And at $42 billion market cap, how much of all of this is priced in, or maybe it should be $22 billion market cap?
Yeah, well, but it's different, though, with this, because there's contracts. There's
sure, but
you know, it's not like you're
competition will come. They
the
won't
consumer.
Be the only person with an electric truck.
Sure. No, but if they're first there, there's a different, you have to go out and shake hands with the Fortune 500 companies. It's a lot different than trying to earn the trust of the person that's just strolling by trying to buy a car because he's 50 or 40 or for his daughter, his first car. Her first car.
All right, coming up, we're just a few hours away from China's stock market reopening. For the first time in more than a week, we'll take you live to Asia with the setup. And speaking of China, take a look at our Cramer cam. Jim is laying out what investors should be keeping an eye on as the trade talks gear up this week. That's top of the hour on Mad Money. We're live at the Nasdaq in Times Square. Much more fast still ahead. Welcome back to Fast Money. We're following two developing stories out of Asia. First, protests continue in Hong Kong. This was the scene overnight as anti-government demonstrators clash with police. A continued unrest comes as China's stock market gets ready to reopen after a week-long holiday. Let's get to Sri Jagaraja live in Singapore with the Asia market setup. Sri.
Hi, Mel. Yeah, there are a couple of opposing forces to consider for the China market reopen later on today. On the negative end of the ledger, it does appear that the US and China don't seem to be fully aligned in terms of the outcome for trade talks. President Trump does expect something substantial. We heard from him earlier on. He does sound optimistic. However, on the Chinese side, they appear to be narrowing the scope of a trade deal. They don't appear to be ready to make any real movement, actually, on the structural issues like IP protection. The yuan, the Chinese currency, in the meantime, that has been weakening in the offshore market, so it's pricing in something of a pessimistic outlook there. So trade uncertainty, that's going to continue to be a feature that will bully the Chinese markets, if not the regional markets as a whole. On the plus side, though, retail spending during the China week-long National Day holidays, that was pretty robust, coming in at growth, returning to growth, actually, of 8.5%. Compare that with the 6.7% decline that we saw the comparable period last year. So that's positive. But the big question moving forward is whether this represents just a flash in the pan, whether it's just a one-off, or whether that is sustainable and continues. So we should get some idea when we get the services sector PMI later on today, and that ought to give us an indication of how the Chinese consumer is holding up. So Mel, all in all, I doubt you'll see any real conviction either way in the China markets at the reopen until we get some real clarity on the final outcome of the trade discussions. Back to you now.
All right, Sri, thank you. Sri Jagaraja. in Singapore for us. What do we expect? I mean, this week-long holiday is typically a big spending week. We typically see a lot of traffic, for instance, in the casinos and in retail stores in China.
Yeah, look, what's happening in Hong Kong is particularly sad. And it, you know, there's a couple things that it will affect. It will affect real estate prices. This is a place that's got a huge property market, and there's arguably a huge property bubble. You are seeing an outflow of capital, as you're seeing an outflow of people. So this is a sad dynamic. China, if you think about their local markets, actually, the CSI 300 has outperformed the S&P by about 5% this year. So, you know, trade war, whatever you want to say, there have been moments. In fact, over the summer before, actually up until the spring, when we had those tweets in mid-May, early May, when Trump, again, threw a lot of cold water on a trade deal, that knocked this thing out of bed, which it hasn't really recovered. But again, China, the local markets, if you're playing them, there's different ways to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, one of them is just the A-share ETF, which is something that gives you exposure to. The markets are incredibly cheap. I mean, on a relative to themselves, they're incredibly cheap. I don't think this news overnight is going to do a whole lot to change that.
I mean, the real standout, actually, of course, is the Nikkei and the Topex. I mean, the Kospi is in a free fall. The Taiwan stock market is also struggling. The Shanghai, HSI, Hang Seng. I'd rather be in Japanese equities here than any other area of Asia Pacific.
Is that like a I'd buy Nikkei, or is it just they look relatively better?
Both. Okay. Absolute and the relative is off the charts.
Yeah. Are you in EM still?
I am. I'm in a number of different ETFs. DXJ is one of them. EEM, which has been a volatile ride. I just feel like I need to have some exposure around the world kind of permanently. Mm-hmm.
If you're looking at the Chinese consumer, what better way to play it than Alibaba? Up 22% year to date. If you're getting a deal or if the consumer is actually spending on an uptick, maybe you want to play that. It's below all three of its moving averages, the 50, the 100, and the 200. So maybe you wind up getting a little bit of a pop going into the deal and coming out where the Asian markets have just been reopened.
In the beginning, were you making the contrast between the Hang Seng and the local Chinese markets because you think the Hang Seng will be lower because of this unrest and the local Chinese markets will do okay?
I think there's more pressure in Hong Kong right now for obvious reasons, and that those markets, and this is kind of what Carter was saying, I think that's not a great looking chart.
No.
Also, overnight, you had FX reserves out of China that came out numbers, and they were lowest since February. So at some point, you're going to start to see more pressure on FX reserves in China again.
All right. Up next, final trades. Time for the final trade. Tim Seymour.
So we talked about restaurant stocks. Starbucks pulled back to this 85 level, which is about a 15% drawback. And expectations now are lukewarm. So I tell you, I like this stock. I'm long. I stay long.
Carter Braxtonworth.
I like Starbucks long and utilities short. XLU, I would use that as a vehicle to hedge if you're long utilities or just go short.
Karen Feinerman.
Yes, so we're going to be starting to see bank earnings next week, which are really important for the banks themselves, but also for their look into the economy, which many of them have a great look, particularly Bank of America, considering I think one out of two families bank there. I'm long. I like it. Obviously, it's a tough market for banks with rates here, but I like it.
Steve Grasso.
About a week and a half ago, I bought Ulta on that huge dip, that big sell-off that they had. I wound up selling it up about 14-15%. I did the same thing with Roku. I'm long. Maybe you should take a shot.
All right. See you back here tomorrow at 5 more Fast. Mad Money starts right now.
CNBC has quick and easy to understand business news updates at the open, midday, and close every weekday. Markets, money, and more from Wall Street to Main Street. I'm CNBC's Jessica Ettinger. Follow and listen to CNBC Business News Updates wherever you get your podcasts.